This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
Technology is now making it so that it's more likely if you have a particular set of views or passions that you're going to find confirming evidence. And as human beings, we interpret the world through stories. We search for confirming evidence of those stories.
What a treat I have for you today. Dr. Daryl Stickle is an executive coach and the founder of Trust Unlimited. He has a PhD in business from Duke University and has worked as a consultant with McKinsey & Company. He's served clients ranging from senior military professionals deployed in Afghanistan to senior wealth advisors and family offices, providing valued advice to some of North America's most wealthy families to chief executive officers running multinational corporations. His specialty and passion is building trust in hostile environments. We know that trust is the number one leadership quality, but how do you build trust? Whether you are a leader, a teacher, a parent, or someone who works with people on a regular basis, you'll come away from this podcast with practical, tactical, and easy to implement strategies to make you better. Enjoy. Well, Dr. Daryl Stickle, thank you so much for joining me today on Kindsight 101. It's a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure, Morgan. I love the work you're doing.
Thank you so much. Likewise, I was so blown away by your presentation and really, really interested to learn more about how do we build trust in these hostile environments, which a lot of workplaces can sort of have elements of that sort of uncertain and difficult environment. So learning some really practical tips for navigating that is pretty exciting. So according to some recent research, you stated that trust levels are globally at the lowest that we've ever seen, and that there's a sharp decline in trust and faith. Essentially, we're sort of in a crisis. Why now, and what's significant about the world in which we live that makes it so difficult to trust?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that we're seeing levels of change and uncertainty that are unprecedented. Technology is advancing so quickly, and we're seeing such a polarization along so many different lines, whether it's religion or geographic or racial or gender or political beliefs. There just seems to be so many reasons for us to disagree. And with the advent of social media and it's changing the way we interact, we seem to be finding more reasons to disagree than to agree. And our attention seems to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And so there's the ability to find new friends or new people who agree with your point of view from anywhere in the world. But there isn't the same impetus to work and develop and build a community locally that there used to be.
Interesting. And so we're kind of seeking this confirmation bias.
Absolutely. And it feels so destructive and counterproductive. It's getting to the place where we're learning that we can't work through things. We can't have dialogue. It's dangerous to disagree with folks from any spectrum. And so I think that one of the things we've been losing is the ability to socialize, the ability to interact in a way that we can come to consensus. The realization that sometimes relationships are going to be rocky and difficult, and that actually can help to strengthen them rather than us just leaving. It's so much easier to leave a relationship now than it ever used to be.
Right. It kind of makes me think of this phenomenon of ghosting. I don't know if you've heard of that, but this is a really common thing with millennials right now, probably everybody actually now, but I think it started with that group and this online dating thing and how easy it is to literally just poof, disappear out of their lives as soon as conflict arises. What do you think the answer is? I mean, this is a big question, obviously, and I think we'll dig in a little deeper, but how do we reframe the way we look at conflict in such a way that it can serve us in our relationships in terms of overcoming those tricky times?
Yeah, so that's a one of my favorite books is a book by a guy named Albert Hirschman, and he wrote it in 1968, I think. It's called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And it looks at the notions of how economists think we react when organizations start to fail versus how political scientists believe we react. And economists think we exit because we've got different options and alternatives. And political scientists believe we use voice. And from their perspective, you can see why that would be the case, because it's hard to leave a country or a region, or it used to be. And so one of the things that I have looked at and spent a long time thinking about is the creation of barriers to exit. So how do we foster environments where there are barriers to us simply leaving a situation because it feels uncomfortable? And if we look at the sort of evolution of our perspective on gay rights and homosexual marriage and those kinds of things, those are actually allowing them to erect barriers to exit by allowing them to marry and making it more socially acceptable and all of those kinds of things. And what we've been systematically doing with the advent of technology and social media and those kinds of things is making it easier and easier for people to leave relationships or situations.
As opposed to using voice to assert themselves or to create a sense of self within that organization or that relationship or whatever. Is that along the right lines?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're bombarded with these notions or these echo chambers. We're seeing now that technology is now making it so that it's more likely if you have a particular set of views or passions that you're going to find confirming evidence. And as human beings, we're kind of victim to that to start with. We interpret the world through stories. We search for confirming evidence of those stories. And it's become easier and easier to find confirmation bias or to find confirmation of stories that we have or narratives that we have with about how the world works or what's right or what's wrong without really listening to alternative stories or narratives.
Right, with like an open heart, without the assumptions, without our own narratives kind of changing the way that we perceive that. And I would even say, and I'm sure you agree, that through the targeted marketing that happens, as soon as an organization or a company or, a social media platform discovers what it is that you're interested in, it literally spoon feeds you more and more and more. So it's like we seek this out intentionally, but it's also hard to escape because it's coming
It,
at us all the time.
absolutely. And one of the struggles that I find with leaders, so I advise senior executives on a fairly regular basis, and I talk to them about this notion that we interpret the world through stories. If you don't tell people your story, if you don't help them build a narrative together with you, then you run the risk of, if you're leading 40 people, or if you have 40 students who have parents telling them stories of the world, you're going to get 40 different interpretations. And so if we don't take the time to actually try to build a shared narrative or explain why we're making the decisions we make, then we run the risk of people having dramatically different perceptions of exactly the same event.
Isn't that amazing? I was just talking to someone yesterday about, in this context, it's a little different, but I think this comes back to the same purpose that you're talking about, this concept of branding a school. And I think sometimes it's misunderstood as a marketing campaign or, trying to head in a particular direction for the purpose of, I don't know, making money or changing the way people see you. But I think that the real purpose behind the notion of branding a school is really getting all of the staff and students and leadership all headed toward the same direction with a similar narrative. Because you're right, I think sometimes with all of these different stakeholders, you can come away from the same experience with a completely different perception of what happened and what some of the issues are. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, You know, there's this one of the notions that we use. So when we talk about building trust, or when I talk about building trust, I talk about reducing uncertainty. And uncertainty can come from the individual, or it can come from the context. And in part, the context is sort of the rules of the game. And if we create a shared narrative, if we create a set of guiding principles and rules that govern our behavior, and we're transparent about that, and we're very clear about it, it actually dramatically reduces uncertainty for folks. Mm-hmm. because they're then able to predict how we're going to behave in a certain situation. And if we can weave a story through that says this is our institution, this is what matters to us, this is what we care about, and this is what that means, and here's how that plays out in our actions and our where we put our energy and activities, then it becomes far easier for folks to understand how you're going to behave in the future.
And then to get on board with you too. I mean, if we're honest, in order to be a leader, you have to have enrollment from people. You have to have a willingness for them to jump on board with you. And I think I would assume that trust is a really big component of that.
Trust is, so the more senior we become, the less direct control we have over outcomes, and the more important those social skills become. And because leaders achieve all of their goals and objectives through the actions of others. Mm-hmm. And often when I'm working with senior leadership, that fact hasn't occurred to them. And it seems to kind of hit them like, oh my God, I'm really dependent on the people that I lead. And I think there's a similar statement could be made about where we're headed in the future. With the advent of artificial intelligence and technology and where the path seems to be leading us, social skills are going to become increasingly important for our students and for the kids that are moving forward. We're moving away from this notion of teaching them math and science and those kinds of things because they're going to need them. Rather, we are focusing more on teaching them how to learn, because things are changing so quickly. They're going to need to be more mentally agile and adept at change than any generation that's preceded them.
Yeah, Dan Pink talked about that a little bit in his book, A Whole New Mind, as well. He talked about the left brain, right brain. I mean, obviously, we need to have some of those analytical, rational skills, but that deep down, it comes down to our ability to connect to one another. And I just think, you know, I had just a really big aha there about leadership, where you just said that the more senior we get, the less control we have over outcome. How interesting, because I think oftentimes, and maybe not everyone, but I think oftentimes there's the perception from quote unquote down below that as you get more senior, you have more control. You might have more control over policy and all of that. But I think really it comes down to that ability to engage and encourage people to be on this journey with you, right?
Yeah, and often we get promoted based on technical skills. And then all of a sudden those technical skills become less and less relevant.
Right.
And it's our people skills that actually differentiate between a truly great leader and one who's just okay.
Interesting. Can you tell me, since we're talking about trust and you are an expert on trust, what is trust?
Trust is the willingness to make yourself vulnerable to another person when you could choose to do otherwise. And so there's elements of uncertainty, vulnerability, and choice. And if we were to think about what that looks like, you know, often I run into just a complete lack of awareness around what trust is and how it works. And people have a sense of it, but it feels fuzzy. And I'll ask people, who do you trust? And then I'll flip that question and say, who trusts you? Mm. And often when I say, who do you trust? We get this sort of deep personal relationships like spouse or siblings or parents or best friends, close family, tight personal relationships. And the reality is we trust people all the time. You know, we trust teachers when we drop our kids off at school.
Right.
We trust cab drivers. We trust restaurants. We trust, it's a social lubricant that allows societies to function.
Right.
And when I flip that question and say, who trusts you? I'll often get a long pause followed by, how would I know? How do I know if somebody trusts me or not? And the answer to that comes from the definition, right? It's How can people make themselves vulnerable to you? And then do they? And so if I'm a teacher and I've got kids in my class, are they willing to take risks? Are they willing to make mistakes? Are they willing to push to the limit of their abilities so that they can really learn? Or do they play it safe and say, no, I'm only going to do the things I'm good at, which is a difficult position to put someone young in, because we're never really good at things we try for the first time.
Right.
And so we have to be able to embrace failure. We have to be able to be comfortable taking risks. We have to have an environment where, you know, and organizations are now talking about innovation and how do we get there. Well, I think it needs to start with teaching kids that it's okay to not be right all the time, that it's okay to try and fail and to learn from that failure. Particularly with this generation that's coming along, because things are going to be changing so quickly and we're going to be new at things all the time.
Yes.
And so how do we create an environment where people are comfortable taking risks, comfortable being vulnerable, sharing things that they're not good at, sharing things that scare them, sharing things that are uncomfortable or that they don't know.
Mm.
And so how do we model that? How do we create environments like that? That's a long answer to your question about what trust is, but essentially, if I'm a leader and my people trust me, they should be coming to me with real development needs. Mm. They should be coming to me pushing back against ideas they don't believe in, or willing to take risks, to come up with things that are outside the box and just try them and be willing to fail.
And even if it might make them feel silly, or it might not work, or it could, I mean, within an unsafe environment, there's the risk of ruining your reputation, that sort of thing. So
right.
Being able to overcome that hurdle and go, yeah, I'm going to put myself out there. I'm going to put my name behind this and I'm going to give it a go. And then knowing that your leadership has your back on that, and that it wouldn't tarnish your image, I guess.
Right. And so a lot of times with organizations now, I'm talking about the fact that we should be maybe changing our focus from rewarding outcome to rewarding process.
Mm.
That if people are engaged in the right activities, then outcomes will take care of themselves if we have the right processes in place. The struggle with rewarding outcomes is often we don't know how rich the environment is, how easy it is to be successful. And so if we're just focused on outcomes and it's impossible to be successful, then that's a pretty stark environment for our followers or our students.
Mm,
but if we're in but if we're in an environment where it's incredibly easy to be successful, then we may be sending false signals to people.
Right. So it's kind of tricky. It's like a balance, right? You don't want it to feel too safe so that people get complacent. And then on the other side, you want people to feel safe enough that they can take risks and do something that maybe scares them a little, but that they have the cushioning of the leadership and the people around them going, yeah, go try it and involve us if you need us to, kind of thing.
Right. We'll provide the resources you need. We'll provide the environment that's safe, and we'll actually celebrate the effort.
Mm.
As long as it's the right process, the right effort.
So I have an interesting, pretty quick little anecdote that I'd love you to comment on, and because sometimes it's nice to have, like you said, people like to process things through story. So
right.
I have a friend who works in a furniture making factory, and it really is a factory. Like, you put things together and you have a roll on this, basically this conveyor belt, and you're assembling things. Well, she took it upon herself one day, noticing that it was taking her extra time to put one tool down to transition and to take another tool for the same station. And so she said, look, I'm just going to put these 10 pieces of furniture together, and then I'm going to transition to the secondary job as a batch, if that makes sense, instead of doing it piecemeal.
Right.
Well, the supervisor came along and had a complete breakdown over it. This is outside of process. This is outside of protocol. He went actually to his supervisor and told him about it. Anyway, my friend had four separate people in management come up to her and reprimand her for having done that. The behavior stopped immediately the first time. But I think about that kind of an environment, it certainly doesn't build trust. It certainly, I mean, I know it's a factory. We're encouraging efficiency over innovation, I'm sure. However, it just makes somebody feel so small. So what's your comment in terms of perhaps how that might have been handled differently, or how that's a reflection of maybe many of our jobs, service jobs out there?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So those are not good environments if you want to have innovation. Those are jobs where you're seeing sort of more and more specialization. And those are the types of jobs that are rife for automation to take over.
Right.
Because people aren't being encouraged to think creatively or innovatively.
That's right.
I'm not a big fan of the repeated criticism or, you know, I know that one of my sons had a mishap at school, and he was chastised by five or six different people.
Right.
And he gets to me, and I said, oh, I heard something happen. And he just curls into the fetal position when he was a little boy. And I said, wow. I said, so are you going to do that again? Like, I just asked him about it. I didn't chastise or punish her or any of those kinds of things. And he goes, no. And I said, that's probably good enough then.
Absolutely.
And I said, you know, you need to know that I still love you for who you are. I still accept you for who you are. And this doesn't change the way I feel about you at all. And this gets, you know, I know you had Alison Reese as one of your interviews. And Alison Reese is amazing. She's fantastic. I did some volunteering with Alison in her life seminars, which I highly recommend. But I was giving a talk to parents about trust and parenting and trying to build stronger relationships with your kids. And the mantra that I have that has sort of spread beyond just my kids is we need to have a relentlessly positive story.
Mm.
And because we interpret the world through stories, we need to start with a positive mindset about our kids. And so, go ahead.
No, sorry. That's so profound, because I think it's tough sometimes because you're trying to model for your children the behaviors that you're expecting, and you know, you have such a reduced time with them. I'm thinking about the stats around, I think it's around 30 minutes that you have of quality time with your family on average per day, if you've, you know, two parents working, that sort of thing. And right. So how important, you're absolutely right. How important is it for those minutes to be positive and for that story that they're hearing about who they are, because so much of it is our voice in their head, right? How important it is for that to be positive. That's so great.
So I'll tell a story about my younger son, Alexander, who's just fantastic. I love my kids. And Alexander, you know, Allison talks about traits. One of Alexander's traits is that he's distractible.
Mm-hmm.
And with each of these traits, there are positive and negative attributes associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the positive traits around him being distractible is that he's amazingly funny. He's very observant. He's just incredibly aware, and he's thoughtful, and he's just a great human being, mm-hmm. but he's also late because he gets distracted. And so one day I was waiting for Alexander outside his school, and Alexander's always late, but on this day he was particularly late. And you know, the other kids have all left, the teachers have left, the janitor's trying to lock the door, and he finally comes out, and he sort of walks up to me, and his head's down, and his feet are kind of scuffling. And while I was standing there waiting, I thought to myself, you know, I have a choice right now. I can either be annoyed and angry because he's late and yell at him. And then I realized everyone's been yelling at him. Mm-hmm. about being late. And it doesn't change the behavior. And it's not intentional. It's just part of who he is. So my other option is to accept him and love him for who he is, all that he is, and not wish that he was somebody different.
That's huge. That's huge.
And so he comes walking up to me and he says, "Dad, I'm really sorry I'm late." And I looked at him and I said, "Buddy, you're worth the wait." And just the relief that he had around that acceptance and the realization that I loved him no matter what time he showed up. And so that's become my mantra with him is if he's late, he's worth it. He's worth the wait.
And then in time, he realizes, like he realizes as he grows up that there will be moments where he can have more and more control over that. And I think kids, I think we expect a lot from kids. And I do the same, you know, you kind of get in the groove and you have high expectations and you got to be places. And then you have to remember that they're still developing and there's still so many pieces that they are going to be putting together into adulthood. And so, yeah, I think sometimes it's such a great thing to have that safe base for them so that they feel right. like a whole loved person, because the alternative and some of the work that I've done around trauma and the effects of a child not feeling like they're accepted are far worse than a little bit of lateness, right?
Right, right. And for me, the realization came that whoever was waiting could wait. Alexander was more important to me than anyone else.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So we know that trust is one of the most important skills, really, or qualities that a leader can have. And how do we actually build trust within the context of leadership? I know that you mentioned in your talk that there are three keys that kind of make for a trustworthy leader. Can you talk more to that?
Sure. So as I said before, there's uncertainty and vulnerability. And what we need to do is understand where does uncertainty come from and where do perceptions of vulnerability come from and how do we manage those to make people more comfortable. And uncertainty comes from two places. It comes from the context and it comes from the individual. And so the individual traits, and this is some of the work that was done by a friend of mine, Roger Mayer, Mayer Davis and Skurman, wrote a seminal work in 1995 about individual trustworthiness. And this is, you know, if you look at the popular press and most of the work that's available to the general public, well over 95% of it will be based on Mayer Davis and Skurman's work.
Wow.
And so they have three core elements that they talk about. They talk about benevolence, integrity, and ability. And those are the three sort of traits that drive our perceptions that someone else is trustworthy. And so I'm going to just go through and define each of those.
That would be great. Yeah, I'd love that.
Yeah. So benevolence is the belief that you've got my best interest at heart and that you'll actually act in my best interest, even if it's not in your own short-term best interest. And the example I use for that is a babysitter. We believe the babysitter will still be there when we get back, even if they get a better offer while we're away. And so a lot of times I'll work with organizations to understand what is benevolence and how do we demonstrate it. And when I was doing some of the giving a talk for Allison's group with Life Seminars, I asked the parents, I said, who here has their kids' best interest at heart? And all the hands go up. And I said, that's awesome. Now, how many of your kids would say that? And about a third of the hands kind of hesitantly rise into the air. And so if we're experiencing a struggle showing benevolence and having it land with our kids where it's supposed to be so obvious, how big a struggle is that going to be for a teacher or a leader trying to demonstrate benevolence to a group that's more disparate and more complex than having a couple of kids?
Right. Absolutely.
So a lot of times we think we're doing something that's benevolent and it doesn't land that way. And I've got to say that for these three elements, benevolence, integrity, and ability, often people say, well, I do all those things. And my response is, says who? Because if it's me saying I do those things, that has a far less weight than somebody else saying, yeah, Daryl does those things. And so for me to build trust with you, you have to perceive that I'm being benevolent, that I have integrity, and that I have ability. And so often we need to include people in that conversation. What are their best interests? What matters most to them? And the place we tend to fall down when it comes to kids is we're often thinking about next week, next month, years down the road. And they're thinking about right now. And so for us to buy the right to talk about later or down the road, we actually need to meet them where they are and say, what matters to you right now? How do I help you be successful in this moment?
Wow.
And so including them in the conversation, and it doesn't always need to be nice, right? We can hold people to a higher standard if they've told us what their goals are and we're transparent around, I'm trying to help you reach the goal that you've set. So I'm going to push you harder for that. And it comes across, it's interpreted so much differently if it's couched in the terms of benevolence, in terms of, you've told me what matters to you, I'm trying to help you get there.
So in terms, can you give me an example of that as it relates to students or to kids?
Sure. My older son, Thomas, loves baseball and he wants to be a baseball player. And so I can have conversations with him around nutrition matters, exercise matters. You need to push yourself. You need to work hard. He would like to be able to go to a U.S. school and get a scholarship to play baseball. Well, okay, then your grades matter. And so you're going to have to work hard at that. And so we can have those conversations around nutrition and homework and exercise that aren't based on some nebulous, it's good for you, but rather it's about, this is a specific goal that you've set. And for you to achieve that, these are the steps you need to take.
What a shift, because I think in terms of how he will perceive future goals, if you're modeling it for him in that respect, then this idea of planning for later makes a lot more sense than, like you said, just simply saying, because I said so, or because that's what kids are supposed to do, or whatever
right.
that is. It has more meaning, right?
Right. And, you know, when Thomas was 12, he's 17 now, but when he was 12, he turned to me one day and he said, you know what, Dad, even when you're upset with me about something, I know it's about what's best for me.
Wow.
It's not what's easiest or what makes you feel good about yourself or just because. It's about what's best for me. And once we get to that place where people actually believe that we're acting in their interest, we have a lot more room to negotiate and navigate. There's a lot more positive interpretation of our actions. We get a lot more flexibility. It creates one of those roadblocks that I talked about, a barrier to exit.
Mm-hmm.
And so around benevolence, we actually need to include people in that conversation. And we need to reference back to it, and we need to be transparent about it.
Mm.
So integrity is the next lever. So I talk about levers and people who are not very good at building trust. We all have the ability to do it, but some are better than others. So those who aren't very good have a lever that they pull.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of it's the ability lever. I have X amount of training, X amount of experience. I've worked with so many people. I've had these successes. We pull the ability lever a lot. And if that's not where the problem lies, so if we're pulling the ability lever and it's a benevolence problem, then we miss.
Right.
So those who are better at building trust understand that there's multiple levers they can pull and they try different things. Those who are really good understand that there's multiple levers and know when to pull which one.
Mm-hmm.
And so integrity is the second lever, and it's, do I follow through on my promises?
That's a big one. Yeah.
It's a huge one because we have a tendency to overcommit. And are my actions consistent with the values that I express?
Hmm.
And so you talked about schools branding themselves and having a story or a narrative. Well, people will look for hypocrisy. And a lot of organizations are really big on, these are our values and this is our mission statement. But they never then link it to behaviors.
Hmm.
And they don't tell the story about how their actions are consistent with the values they've expressed. And sometimes we have a misconnect where we've made a promise to someone and they've heard something different than what we said,
mm-hmm.
or what we interpret. And so then we think we've followed through on the promise and they don't. And so a lot of times when I talk to people about integrity, I'll work with them around creating a consistency and being transparent around what my narrative is, how does that link? And I'm going to create the story with you together about this is the commitment I've made, this is me following through on it, this is what I'm going to do next. And so if we can create a pattern of behavior that's easy for us to predict, it's much easier for us to have integrity because we know what we're going to do next.
Right. And I mean, I'm just thinking right now of, because it sounds like I think organizations can have integrity as well, right? And so I'm just thinking right now of a particular situation where a parent was promised some things at a different time from some different people. And this year, the perception of what they were promised versus what is happening in the system is not measuring up. And when I think about why is that, her ideal vision of what support would look like and all of that, and what she heard about in terms of the promises last year are very different than the reality.
Right.
And what I think those people were initially saying. So that integrity piece is so affected by the perceptions as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the places where organizations really seem to run into trouble is the gap between sales and marketing and the rest of the organization.
Tell me more about that. Yeah.
Well, sales and marketing tend to make promises. And then it's on everyone else to follow through and deliver on those promises that have been made, often without including them in that conversation.
Right.
And so, you know, if I'm in sales, I get rewarded for getting someone to buy the product or enroll in the institution or become a member or whatever it is. And then I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the organization is then saddled with these commitments that I've made, and they may be vague in nature. And a lot of times organizations will fall down for two reasons. One is that commitments have been made that have then not been followed through on. Another is, you know, we end up with so many different folks, you know, the frontline staff who are engaged with the public are in such transition that they don't really understand what the organization can and can't do. And we see a lot of organizations saving a lot of money, I'll put that in air quotes, by having cheap labor interact with their customers.
Like call centers and that sort of thing?
Yes. And you never deal with the same person twice, and they all have a slightly different interpretation of how things work, or they don't really know how things work, and they're just learning. And then as they get up the curve, they realize, wow, I'm not getting paid very much, and the benefits are terrible, and this is really an awful situation, so I'm going to leave. And the impact that has on us as someone who's dealing with an organization that we feel has made promises to us is one of cynicism.
And that, I think, applies to education too, right?
It does. I know that there's a school here in Victoria where my sons both went. I was shocked to see that over a third of the teachers were on one-year contracts. And I suspect that that's cheaper for the school, but the implications it has for the consistency and quality of education that the kids receive are pretty profound.
Yes. Yes. Well, and because teachers don't know where they're at, it may not be their favorite place to be, all sorts of different things, right? They simply don't have the expertise with that age range.
Right.
Many different reasons. Yeah.
Oh, it throws such complexity into the mix. So that's the integrity piece. And then the ability piece is the sort of last lever. And as I said, a lot of people like to pull it, but often I find that organizations are profoundly underdefined when it comes to what excellence is. And so, as an example, I was working with a mutual fund company, and they had frontline staff, middle managers, and senior executives all in the room. And I said, if I broke you into those three groups, would you all agree on what an excellent middle manager is? And the response was, wow, we wouldn't agree within those three groups. And a lot of times I'll be in front of a group of senior executives and I'll say, who here's a great leader? And all the hands go up and I'll say, okay, what does that mean? And then they just stare at me. Right? I don't know. And they kind of go, well, it just seemed like something I should think that I'm good at.
Right.
And so if we don't define these things, then how do we recruit for them? How do we reward for them? How do we train for them? How do we articulate to the world what excellence is so that we can be evaluated against that?
What are some ways that people can define what excellence is for them? Are there any guiding questions or?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a great question. So a lot of times, if I were a teacher, which I kind of, I am, I mean, yes. I teach workshops and I guide and develop people. So I believe that I would play a role in defining what excellence is as a teacher, but I can't do that on my own. So I actually need to reach out to my constituents, to the other key stakeholders. So I need to ask my students, what does excellence look like as a teacher? And I need to ask my colleagues, my peers, what do you think excellence looks like as a teacher? And then I need to ask the people that I'm working for, my superiors or the people that I report to, what do you think excellence looks like as a teacher? Because they're all going to have slightly different perspectives.
Hmm.
And I need to take into account all those perspectives and from those define what I think excellence means. And then go back to those stakeholders and say, here's what I've defined it as. And here's how I've incorporated the different views of the different parties. And now here's what I'm going to hold myself to.
Hmm.
And so in part, you know, if my students aren't getting the material, if they aren't thriving and successful, that's on me.
Right.
And so I believe that I play a role, much as the student has to put in effort and they have to be willing and open. But I have a significant role in making sure that those materials come across in a way that makes sense.
And that's so interesting because I think sometimes, and maybe I'm speaking from experience, but I've kind of gone through a bit of an evolution coming from a place of just broadly wanting to please everyone,
right?
Which is kind of it's just not a possible thing. It kind of burns you out. It's actually not, it doesn't really make you feel like you're living in your own integrity either, to, yeah, being a little bit more careful about what success looks like for me as an educator in the way that I interact with parents, with students, and with, you know, my colleagues, and then of course with administration. So that's a really, I love the questions there because that's a great guide to going beyond just being a pleaser and trying to make everyone happy, to really dialing in on what is it to be a good teacher and looking at it through those different lenses as well.
Absolutely. And then we're not as vulnerable to the vagaries of one outlier saying, well, you should be able to sing and dance.
Right.
Well, I can't sing and dance. Well, then you're not a good teacher. Well, okay. So that's not part of my definition of what excellence is.
That's right. That's
and,
right.
And so by defining this, it actually is very freeing,
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways, because now we know what we've defined excellence as, and we're able to articulate that to folks, and we're able to say, this is how that manifests. This is what it looks like when it happens. And, you know, if you have expectations outside that, well, then that's your issue. It's not my responsibility.
Right. And it changes what you evaluate yourself against and one another as well. And I think even for an administrator, they have a different set of parameters through which they evaluate their, you know, teachers as well. Right.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So we are kind of closing in on our timeline right now. I'm just wondering if you had any other pieces that you wanted to touch on before we do our last three questions.
Yeah, I think, so I agree that, you know, you've said that trust is incredibly important and we're getting less and less of it. My wish is that schools actually thought more holistically about some of these interpersonal skills, because it looks like we're failing In terms of the approach we're taking to building trust, the traditional approaches that have worked. And I have concerns about that. And I think that it may need to be something that starts at a next generation level, where they start to figure out how to manage technology, how to manage relationships, how to engage with one another in a way that's productive. And I know that a good friend of mine, David Obstfeld, is working on a education grant around teaching underprivileged kids social skills, because it's been defined or identified as one of the key factors that defines success or failure for kids as they grow up. And that seems to be a deficit that underprivileged kids face. I'd like to see schools doing more of that.
Neat. I think that would be great. And I think there's some work, and it's definitely been written into the curriculum that social and emotional learning is an important target. And I think the facilitation of it and the rolling out of the curriculum is sort of what is helping us to redirect that focus. However, I think we still have lots of room to grow. So
yeah.
But it's a good conversation, because I think it all starts with those big questions and redefining what our purpose is and why, right?
Right.
Yeah. So what does kindness mean to you?
I think that kindness is an intentional act or a choice to make someone else's life better in some way. And I think it needs to be a choice that we make, but it also needs to be perceived as kindness by the other party.
Oh, that's interesting. What trait or superpower should an educator lead with in order to be effective?
I think that leaders or educators need to create an environment, and this is my bias, but an environment where everyone's comfortable contributing. Everyone's comfortable participating. So it has a trust component to it.
And if you were to print one quote or message onto one of those cups sold in big bookstores, what would it be?
There's an African proverb I like, which is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And I think that often the struggle we have when I'm talking with organizations about trust is they say, oh, that's a long-term thing. We've got all these immediate problems, and I'm being evaluated today on my work yesterday. I think we need to still maintain a notion that collaboration is what breeds success for organizations and communities.
Powerful. We're better together.
Yeah.
Daryl Stickel, thank you so much for joining me today on Kindsight. It's been a pleasure, and I've learned a lot about trust, and I've learned a lot about just making small shifts in my thinking that could actually ripple out and have some pretty, pretty huge impact on the way that I run my classroom in my work. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Morgan. It's been a pleasure.
It was great. Thanks.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.